Josh Priest, who is a graduate student of mine, Georgios Mikolodrakakis, who is just graduated with his PhD, Sylvie Pupu, who is was an undergraduate, amazingly, for all this work, and most recently also with Amos Yoron. First, also let me thank the organizers for the privilege of speaking. And just in a naive way, ask, why should we be doing this? Well, there's N equals 4 stuff. If you're used to QCD, it looks pretty far from the real world. But I would say, in brief, the reason to keep doing it is that there is a chance that it might work fairly well, and I will try to quantify that fairly well by the end, and you can judge whether it meets your standards of fairly well. And it's the most simple example of ADS-CFT. So that, when you calculate something with N equals 4, there's a lot less theoretical uncertainty, let's say. You don't have to plow through as much tough stuff, whether on the gravity side or on the field theory side. Well, I remember in a quantum field theory course, David Grosskopf, he recently described N equals 4 as the would-be harmonic oscillator of interacting quantum field theories. And what's lovely about ADS-CFT is that his recent observation is true, at least in the strong coupling limit. And perhaps I'm rehashing points that other speakers have made, so I'll go quickly. But above TC, if you believe Lattice results, there is no chiral symmetry breaking. Also, there's no confinement, and that's well supported by data as well. So, there's not a qualitative difference in the phase that we're talking about versus N equals 4. But at the same time, we can't expect perfect agreement. We're not talking about something like universality in critical exponents, where there's a definite limit that makes things the same that start out different. So we're making comparisons that I have characterized in print as being charitably described as uncontrolled. Still, we start with some suggestive estimates of entropy and viscosity, and we want to know what form might there be. All right, so let me go through this little drag force computation that was done by Herzog, Carlton, Koskos, is that how you say it? Karch and Yaffe, and also by myself. I'll omit the D7 brain and just think about a quark with infinite mass, because I want to sort of remain pure here. Just do N equals 4 with the ingredients that N equals 4 has to offer. And those include external quarks, described as a string hanging from the boundary of Anti-De Sitter space that has infinite mass, infinite momentum. But nevertheless, its momentum might change finitely over time. And that finite derivative, dpdt, is what one calculates. So how does it go? Well, you get some ansatz for the shape of the string in terms of a functioning psi of the depth, which I like to call y and make it dimensionless. So psi is some amount by which the string trails behind the quark as a function of depth in ADS. And you pull out your good old friend, the Nambu action. The dilaton is zero or constant in the ADS background, so we don't have to worry about that bit. The string metric comes from the induced metric in ADS, and here is that metric. So I'll keep using this dimensionless y, such that G00 is proportional to 1 minus y to the 4th. And if you like, the z coordinate that's been used by other speakers is simply zh times y. And this zh is the length, it's 1 over pi times the temperature. Anyway, you get your equations of motion, you find the solutions I've described, and then you want to know, based on the solution, what is the drag force? And Philip had a nice intuitive picture that, yes, somehow it's from the angle of the string. The string is pulling back on that quark. But the way that I found it convenient to calculate was to consider the world sheet current of space-time energy momentum. So alpha is a world sheet index. This is a current on the world sheet which is conserved. Its conservation is precisely the Nambu equations of motion. But mu means that it's a current of space-time energy momentum. So it tells you how fast does energy drain down the string. How fast does forward momentum drain down the string. That's exactly what this thing, what this capital P is for. And so in order to ask what is this derivative of P, I see I have a little typo here. dP dt is this delta P over delta T if we can consider a finite interval. But I should have had on the left, in the last expression right here, the 1 over delta T, because I'm just, I'm integrating over some interval of time, and I asked how much forward momentum drained down the string, down toward the horizon. And so there's a picture of it. You've got forward momentum as well as energy draining down the string. All right, so it's irresistible, but plug in a few numbers, what do you get? You get that the momentum of the string dies up exponentially with a time scale which is something like 0.6 centimeters over C with the choices of parameters so indicated. And that's a pretty short time scale. It certainly would indicate that charm flows, but it probably indicates that charm flows more than experimental data would support. So I will return to the question, as other speakers have done, of how we make perhaps more meaningful comparisons between N equals 4 and QCD. Okay, so we shouldn't neglect to consider another effect from the trailing string, and that is that, as our speakers have commented upon, there is a sort of horizon on it. And the way I like to think of it, in lieu of drawing some kind of Penrose diagram, as Derek did so clearly, the way I like to think about it is that if you are standing on this string and you're trying to stay at the same altitude, you can do it. You can keep your footing if you are above this critical value of y. And did I write it down here? If I didn't, here's some nice red chalk. Yv equals fourth root 1 minus b squared. So you can keep your footing on this string and stay at the same elevation if you are above this horizon. And if you're below this horizon, you just can't. Someone who is trying to stand here and stay at the same elevation would be following a space-like trajectory. Can't do it. So instead, you're going to inevitably slip further and further down the string. So that makes it seem pretty intuitively obvious that this is the world sheet analog of a black hole horizon. And as such, you would think that maybe there's some Hawking radiation from this horizon. So what might that Hawking radiation do? Well, it would go sort of back up the string, and it would sort of jerk the quark around in some stochastic fashion. Now, I didn't quite calculate that. But Derek and I, Jorge Castelder y Solano, did something that is closely related. We considered the two-point function of the force on the quark, or the stochastic component of the force on the quark, because we're not thinking about the drag now. We're thinking about that portion which relates to fluctuations of the string that would be Hawking radiated. Okay, so just to present the result first, what we found is that there is some two-point function of the stochastic force where this kappa T constant is closely related to the drag force. It just has a little bit of extra dependence on the velocity through gamma. But this is not quite the end of the story. It's not quite noise. Not exactly. Instead, you get some centralized Whiting function of the following form. Capital G sub t takes a scaling form where I just scaled out a bunch of quantities that don't depend on time, but do depend on, for instance, velocity of the port. And then you just get this scaling function, lowercase g of t, which depends on a rescaled time, rescaled by a power of the temperature, and rescaled, interestingly, by a power of the Lorentz boost factor. And so I'll just show you this function. There's a scaling function. And to me, the main things to note are, great, it has fast fall off at large L. And that's the sense in which calling it white noise is not such a terrible idea. You go to long times, all the structure of this function is evidently for finite L, and so you replace it by a del function that does not seem like a great sin. But we should remember that the relationship between T and L included a factor of gamma. So when the quark is moving faster and faster, it is more and more simple to replace this function by a delta function. So that's one little wake-up call that I started off being too naive in using Lanzmann dynamics. Like I should have realized from the start that there's some finite time correlations. Perhaps a stronger wake-up call that not all is well with this picture is that when you calculate in precisely the same way the stochastic component of the force along the direction of the quark's motion, it is larger than the transverse stochastic fluctuations by a factor of gamma squared. In fact, that there's a very simple identity that the two-point function, the symmetrized Weismann two-point function for those longitudinal fluctuations is exactly, for all t, for all other parameters, gamma squared times the transverse one. And so that results in a diffusion constant which has this horrendous factor of gamma 5 halves on it. And yes, Derek and I agree about this factor 5 halves. And that exceeds the prediction of the Einstein relation by a considerable factor. So again, it points to the fact that probably I was naive in using Lanzmann dynamics to start. I would like to believe that it's telling you something interesting and coherent. Namely, that as the quark goes along, it's quickly trading momentum back and forth between itself and nearby color fields. And maybe that's too glib, but maybe there's some grain of truth. Okay, I've already.
L, again, in your plot, there is the horizontal axis is L. I can miss this. L.
It's right L here. Okay. So it's rescaled by power of the temperature, but also this factor is important. So that when the quark is really fast, this time, say 2 here, might be 2 factors.
But it's not a gamma, it's not where it's spawn time or something.
Yeah.
It's
square root. That's true. Right. So it's not it's not that fast dependence. But there is some dependence. Okay. So there's also limits on the value of gamma that you can use in this construction. It's not entirely clear that you ever really have problems. We could try to work the numbers a little bit and see if we can. Right, as I've remarked, finite mass quarks and the limits of conformal invariance would set some limit on gamma, but I tend to think that limit is okay for considering, say, charm quarks and certainly B quarks at break. If you want to convert these kappas into analogs of Q hats defined in terms of this momentum diffusion, it really amounts to just a factor of 1 over B. So I include these just for reference.
Yeah. Well, gamma is exactly the behavior of correlation times, or of coherence times of collinear emission in the LPM region. So that suggests.
Okay.
It's also synchrotron radiation is a rate. because it's a formation lens is very big. And it's relatively similar to what you're saying.
Mm. Okay, thank you. All right, so I've tried to emphasize this notion of energy draining down the string.
So can I ask you, are you saying that in the boundary theory, when our four-dimensional world, some energy is leaking the extra dimension?
Well, this is exactly what I was about to say. That I've emphasized how we have some energy drain, like down plumbing in the sink. And that does not feel at all right. Energy is conserved in four dimensions. But in fact, there's no contradiction. It's the calculations that I've done so far have been really in string language. And we can go back to the field theory language and look at the stress tensor and see the dissipation in purely four-dimensional terms by converting this whole five-dimensional picture into four-dimensional terms. And the way that that's done is to propagate gravitons sourced by the string to the boundary and extract from them the stress tensor with some holographic ADS-CFT prescription. And this is a somewhat torturous computation, so I won't give you any detail. But just suggest that this is something that's best attacked first in Fourier space, where in Fourier space you have some co-moving ansatz where all the dependence on x1 and on t is through this combination. So the gravitational fields are moving with the quark. And when I show you plots, I again like to scale out some factors of temperature with extra factors of pi on them. And I also tend to like to scale out factors of tip falling and gamma. So what you find when you do this graviton propagation is that there is a broadly peaked wick of stress energy in the dual gauge theory. And it is, I would say, at least reminiscent of data, but with a smaller Mach angle. And what I'm about to show you really, is very much incomplete because it is a momentum space comparison from the ADS side, and data on the experimental side. So I have not, for instance, done patronization. What I've done to make this curve is I've just looked at the Fourier coefficients at some fixed value of the wave number, and I chose 1.4 GeV because that's the typical momentum of an associated hadron in these Phoenix plots. But what I have not done is follow through some Cooper Fry prescription. So the dashed line is some analytic approximation. The numerical line is I believe, quite accurate. And what you see here, the green line, is the Mach angle for conformal theory. And as other speakers have remarked, the Mach angle that is suggested by the data is somewhat smaller. So the equation of state here is tripping us up, and that's something that you just shouldn't expect to get right when comparing n equals 4 to QCD.
What are you plotting here? Is this energy as a function of angle, or is this particle number as a function of angle? What determines the amplitude of that?
Energy density. Energy density is on the vertical axis.
Energy density per cubic Fermi?
No, it's the
number. More precisely, over density. So there's a sonic boom rolling out. You look at it in K space. So I have not yet passed to position space. You look at it in K space, Fourier coefficients of the energy over density for fixed wave number as a function of angle. That's what's being plotted. So if I were to take the fixed wave number to be very, very small, then this broadly shaped peak will tighten right up into nearly a delta function because that's what you expect from a sonic boom at a definite Mach angle. But when you have one of the charms of ADS-CFT is that you have simultaneous access to all wave numbers. And so I've gone to wave numbers that are comparable to the temperature, comparable to the mean free path perhaps, and this thing just broadens out. There's hydrodynamical broadening that could be compared to this, and I'm coming to. Anyway, I emphasize again, this is a preliminary comparison because we're not hadronizing, we're not passing to this place yet.
I mean, do you have an idea whether the amplitude is observable?
Let me return to that. So, okay, so you do want to go to position space because, for instance, to apply something like Hoover Fry, of course, you have some position space, a starting point. And with Amos and with Silvio, we've been busily working out that position space form, and I've recently learned that Larry Yaffe with a student has been working on very similar things. And so here's, for instance, a plot of the energy over density for an offset from the quark. This x of p is something like the following. Let's say the quark is going off like in this direction. Then xp is, we're considering a plane that is some orthogonal distance away from the quark's trajectory. And we're talking in units, xp is 6. That's about 1.2 femtometers. So we're still fairly close to the quark. And what we see is that the red curve, which is essentially linearized hydro, is starting to fit pretty well already at 1.2 femtometers. Well, further and further, the red curve is going to take over. The green curve is some numerical correction. The blue curve is the Coulombic field plus corrections to it. So what we have in the left hand plot is the energy over density very, very close to the quark, and it's dominated by these near field quantities. And then as you zoom further and further away, you get back to X1 is the direction of motion of the quark. So along the hockey stick is X1, above the hockey stick is XP.
And the quark itself is at X1 equals 0?
It is at X1 equals 0. So the red dot is where you'd expect from the Mach angle to see a peak. So if I went up really, really far, XP of 10,000, then this peak is going to tighten up right around the red dot. But it'll always be a little ahead of it.
Because closer to
the
it's
wrong. Yeah. So the right answer in terms of your curves is what?
The black curve is the sun. So in order to pass the position space description, we simply split up the Fourier coefficients into some U, V, I, R, and remainder pieces and handle them separately, and this is what we got. And then the blue dots indicate an expected amount of hydrodynamical broadening. You have this 8 over s equals 4 pi, 1 over 4 pi. That translates into a diffusion of sound waves, and if you estimate based on that rate of diffusion and the particular xp that you chose, how wide your peak should be, well, it's the blue dot show.
That's the hydrodynamic broadening in an infinite homogeneous medium.
Yes, this is an infinite homogeneous medium. I will come to the question of an expanding medium very soon.
How do you interpret the deficit to the left of the polyquant?
Well, the quark is pushing up energy density in front of it, and that deficit behind.
It grows the size, so it should come from there is deficit behind.
But it's not at xp equals 6. It's not behind. Oh, I guess you're sort of as you go further back, you're catching the weight behind
it. Right.
If you did it at x equals 0, do you see it being negative from the beginning? So from all the way from x1 equals 0 all the way back?
In the absence of a plot, I'm not going to comment, but I would. My intuition is yes. But let me not comment.
Like this. Yeah.
So we've been working on the pointing vector as well, and there is a strong diffusion wick in the terminology of Chauliac and Calderon-Solana. So really, the answer to your question is we have to decide quantitatively the relative strength of the diffusion wick in the moon, and that would be our best point of comparison with the kind of thing else. So let me see, I'm 25 minutes, right?
10 minutes left.
That's not right. That would be only 35 minutes. I have 40 minutes. Good.
You're right.
All right. So we don't want to do expanding. We don't want to do infinite static media. We want to do an expanding plasma. And this is, of course, a bit trickier. But we should not neglect to eat any free lunches that may present themselves. So this is a free lunch. There is, in string theory, a solution, the global ADS phi Schwarzschild solution, which is dual to a static plasma on S3. So it starts out in ADS, which depends on the diagram I've drawn, as just some static black hole doing nothing, just sitting. And its dual description is a uniform static plasma on S3. So that looks extremely boring. But to spice it up, we can conformally transform from S3 cross R to Minkowski space, because after all, S3 cross R is the covering space, the conformal covering space of Minkowski space. And I've tried to indicate that covering relationship by slicing ADS like so and like so. And on the boundary, that results in a diamond, which is the Penrose diagram of Minkowski. So if you like, the black hole is in these coordinates of a Poincaré patch. It is rising out of a zero temperature horizon, heading toward the boundary, and then falling back into another zero temperature horizon. So that's indicated best by this plot. The black hole is trying to come out toward the boundary. And with a conformal transformation, you can make it come out further and further. And all this is dual to a purely radial flow of a finite medium with no shear and no entropy production. We call it a conformal soliton. So this conformal soliton owes its existence solely to the existence of a conformal transformation between S3 cross R and the Minkowski space. And that conformal transformation involves time. So it turns something that was static into something that's dynamic. So, why expanding plasmas?
I'm confused. What's the picture that you are dual to? Is it a sphere that expands homologously? So you have a flow profile that is zero in the center and increases monotonically to the outside?
So I've tried to give you more detail here. You've got, let's say, it's time symmetric. This is the fun thing about it. It's time symmetric. So you've got an imploding spherical shell of matter that comes in. Maximal compression at time equals zero. This is the detailed profile in the positive R, positive T plane. And as it's going out, you can see that it goes out asymptotically in a light-like fashion. That's dictated essentially by conformal invariance. So this is what we've got.
You create this here, and then there is nothing again. So it is not trying.
Right.
That is not a production, because it is all shared.
That's right. It was, after all, it was dual to something. It was conformal to something static. So it's time dependence is sort of a thing.
Does it bounce?
Absolutely, it bounces. I've shown it right here. You think of this whole thing as rotated around the t-axis and symmetric around the r-axis, and you've got this imploding shell.
And it's boosting there.
No.
Spherically symmetric is true. Yeah. Boosting it would, you could have two of these things and boost them for each other. So that's still a little bit boring, but what if we were to be terminally optimistic and say, I want to compare it to a Rigg collision? How would you do it? Well, you would say, I want to have something that is about as big as a gold nucleus compared to the typical length of the problem, which is set by the temperature. In other words, you want T peak temperature times L to be something like what you find in the Rigg collision. So that turns out to mean you want a big black hole. So this initial picture was very misleading. This looks like a small black hole in a big anti-sitter space. The other way around, you have an enormous black hole that's much bigger than the radius and curvature of ADS. It's very unlike black holes in flat space. And now the game we can play is to say, let's perturb this thing. Let's add some elliptic flow. Or let's add some hydrodynamical and non-hydrodynamical modes. And our two observations are, number one, the perturbations of this black hole split into quickly decaying modes whose e-folding time is something like 0.08 femtometers if you go through the numbers the way I indicated. So you've got a very fast approach to hydrodynamical validity. And when you go and look at the hydrodynamical modes that are left when you relax away these fast modes, you find excellent agreement with the linear x-hydro approximations using eta over s equals 1 over 4 pi. And so we went so far as to compute the elliptic flow normalized by the initial eccentricity, and because this is all somehow SO4 group theory at some level, we could get an analytical formula in terms of one number, which is a quasi-normal frequency of the black hole that has to be computed numerically. And so we compute it numerically, and we get elliptic flow as 0.7, and the experimental number average over PT is 0.32. Doesn't sound too bad. But again, I would emphasize that there's substantial naivete here. We didn't hadronize. We don't have the V equals 0 plateau. And perhaps worst of all, we have perturbed a radial flow. We were not supposed to do that. We were supposed to perturb your cane flow. So, apologies made. Let's try to do as well as we can. Let me go back a little bit and say that despite the imperfections of this model, I would take this thermalization time a bit more seriously than the elliptic flow calculation. Because what we're saying is that there's a clean divide of modes, fast and slow. Slow is hydrodynamic. Fast is the approach to hydrodynamics. How fast is the approach to hydrodynamics? Well, given the level of anisotropy that you start out with in a Rick collision, we would estimate it to be something like 4 e-folding times. And that gives you 0.3 femtometers. And that's kind of a halfway reasonable number, maybe a little low.
What would be the total energy if you think of simulating a high energy collision? What would be kind of the initial condition here? Total atomic number, this gradient of conformal symmetry.
I'm thinking of a central Rick collision, so I have 400 influence. Is that your question?
Yeah, but what is the energy? What is it in this
40
dB?
Well,
you are conformal completely,
but
you don't have any.
That's a good point, but all it means is that I get to compare dimensionless things to dimensionless things. So I compare the typical radius of the Rick fireball, which I take to be 7 femtometers, and the temperature when it first thermalizes, which is something like 300 MeV.
But you have radius solution, you have one parameter there.
So I compare a dimensionless thing to a dimensionless thing, and the dimensionless thing on the ADS side turns out to be the radius of the Schwarzschild black hole divided by the scaling curvature of ADS. So I really have two things that I can compare dimensionless with. Okay, so let me get to the finale here. To compare n equals 4 and QCD, we've heard several different descriptions. One that I favor is this one in green. So first, let's think about the one in blue, kind of obvious. Temperatures are as far as supposed to be compared at equal values. And for the Chouf coupling, we choose some value of alpha s to be a half. That's reasonable. But I like this green one.
And you're equating the Chouf coupling in the two theories.
Yes, you're absolutely. That's this equals something. But I would like to espouse this one. And let me go quickly here and say why. That I want to compare the strength of QQ bar interactions between string theory and the lattice. And what I try to handle is this contribution to the string theory force. I commented upon this one, and it has subsequently been explored by Yaffe and Karch and Bach. And so I'll even include that in my final comparison table. So anyway, you find that the effective coupling, alpha strong, defined in this way, depends on square root of Chouf coupling rather than Chouf coupling directly. So it's a little odd to see this dependence here versus this kind of dependence, which you figure is going to be a G strong squared quantity. But anyway, that's the physical comparison that I propose. And when you go off and plot the string theory value of alpha versus lattice, this is from Karch-Marek and collaborators, this is lattice, this is string theory, you find something that's a little embarrassing, that that U-shape only carries you out to a fairly small radius. And it's even worse if you compare at equal temperatures rather than equal densities, as I prefer, equal energy densities, as I prefer. But I'm just going to go with this and say, it's the best that I can do with the calculations that I know how to do. And I'm going to use that to set GA mils equals, tip coupling equals 5.5. I would be very interested in some further calculations that would extend sort of this curve all the way down, including normalization as well as shape. Yes. All right, so here's my sort of punchline table from the title of my talk. A few comparisons between N equals 4 C3M mils and QGPs. Well, there's the entropy deficit. We've heard about it. In the representative range. Eta over S. It's a little concerning to me that this depends so sensitively on lambda. That 135 is a big number. And when we go down to lambda of 5.5, the correction term is as big as the original. But still, it puts us within range. I would interpret RIC data as supporting some range roughly like this. Thermalization time, considering four defoldings in the setup that I described, 0.3 centimeters, 0.4 centimeters. The difference here is that in my alternative prescription, I propose to normalize energy density equals energy density, which means the temperature on the Yang-Mills side is about 30% lower for a meaningful comparison. So with this smaller value of the Tuft coupling, the drag force gets smaller. So instead of getting this 0.65 centimeters, which was, I thought, uncomfortably small, now we get a relaxation time of about 2.1 centimeters. And I would interpret the data as supporting a range or favoring a range, something like this. Q hat has some uncertainties that have been discussed. It's very sensitive to temperature. And there's different ways of thinking about how to define it that I've already alluded to. But the ranges are acceptable. I would, in these comparisons here, I would set T equals 250 MeV, not 300, because when I read the Phoenix White Papers, I read that energy density at a femtometer is supposed to be 5.5 BeV per femtometer cubed. When I convert that to temperature, I get 250 MeV, not 300. This range, okay, maybe this is a little inclusive. I guess there's some controversy on that too. And finally, from Yaffe and Company's recent paper, the debye, which again is kind of lining up not too badly with lattice. So I would say in conclusion that it looks fairly good to me, but it depends on your standards. It's better than I could have hoped 10 years ago, better than I would have imagined it could be. It could be that we're getting approximately right answers, though, for wrong reasons. I would counter that it's a good start to consider a strongly coupled gauge theory in a finite temperature phase, as we do with Alpha-Carroll symmetry breaker confinement. And I would end with the thought that a measure of success in ADS-CFT since its inception was the degree to which we could understand things from both sides, from the field theory side, from the gravity side. Confluence of the two meant that we really understood something. And I hope that it might prove to be the same in this new field. Yes, sir.
Can you go back to the summary table?
Oops.
So just a comment. You have in the second bottom row, you have Q hat and Q hat T. The only one that could be compared to the thing extracted from data is Q hat. Because Q hat T, if you take gamma to 1, which you have to do, I'm sorry, gamma to infinity, which you have to do to reach the thing which is defined by the formalism which is used to extract the data, it would become infinite. In the formalism which is used to do the extraction from data, what you're calculating is on the light count. So I don't know how you can compare Q hat T to data, but it's not that data. And as to how to do the comparison for Q hat, you're right about the uncertainty. If you choose a prescription for lambda, it will certainly do what you say there. But if you use the 8 over S results, then it'll do what I said. So it time will tell.
So I guess my only remark to reply would be that that when one is thinking about charm forks, which is what I purport to do when certainly when I'm thinking about Q has to peak, that that the Lie-like approximation is maybe not so close to the data.
Well, then don't include ours.
Julie, next question.
We wouldn't compare the
comment. I mean, when you compare it to data, energy density you quoted from Phoenix is based on the Bjorklund formula, which assumes that expansion without doing longitudinal work. But the actual energy, thermal energy density is higher than that. This is a lower estimate. Also, it's the average over the transverse profile. And so it's about twice that in the middle and, of course, less at the edge. Hmm. How do you know that the average is the right thing to compare? Or is there any hope in the future to make your calculations even more detailed so that you can take into account spatial profiles of energy density and temperature?
Well, maybe my most meaningful reply would be that I very much hope that a holographic description of a finite extent Bjorklund flow may be found. That would perhaps clarify the issue. As for which temperature to choose, well, of course, I defer to you on the question of estimates. And to me, what's most meaningful to look at in these four boxes is comparative sizes. If we want to crank up the temperature from 250 to 300, okay. But I think it's quite interesting that, for instance, this number comes out bigger. And that's, to me, that's a puzzle. Why should there be more momentum diffusion apparently for time?
I want to comment about what you call privilege about this data concept. This is a beautiful thing which one can say is having density of Brookhaven but geometry of Livermore. That is precisely the solution which I was looking at in my 71 paper, the spherical explosion quantum plasma. I couldn't find an original one. That's a beautiful one. The other thing I have to say that, in fact, in a paper with these ones I have and seen like 3 years ago now, and they say if all the junk from the collision, which is falling in NDS, create a black hole, a departing black hole, looks like a spherical explosion for the observer on the bottom. And we have, again, qualitative explanation how it works, and this is an exact analytic solution. Now, if we try to make superposition of those distributed longitudinally, we will get non-spherical solution, which looks more like a realistic solution. Yes.
Well,
unfortunately, it's non-linear, so.
One thing we could do is to push the linear perturbation theory that we've done as far as it will go toward your thing flow. And that would not affect the elliptic flow estimate that we did because it's linear perturbation. But what one really wants is a proper solution flow and finite
extension.
So we'll hear more, no doubt, about your thing flow.
I have two
main
questions. So first question about this calculation of weight, then the energy profile that you pointed out. So could you remind where the factors of NC go? Because it seems that as you take NC to infinity, the amplitude to meet this graviton would go to zero. But on the other hand, if you just look at this expression for the friction coefficient, it does not have any factors of NC. So that's one question. And second question is, this thermalization time in the table was obtained from basically analysis of small perturbation of something that already has a well-defined temperature. So it's not clear why this is related to what people actually call thermalization time in the collision, where you have initial state of, you know, unthermalized atoms there.
Very good. We comment upon this in our paper, and I should have mentioned it in the talk, that this is this T-therm is a late-term tail of the process of thermalization. And we did not have a way of considering the earlier stages of thermalization. However, there have been other studies which do precisely that and wind up with rather simple answers. Remind me, your first question had to do with?
It's about the factors of NC.
Okay, so what I would hold on to there is that indeed the drag force does not depend directly on n, it depends on square root of lambda. And one of the things that you can show that I just didn't have time for is that this exact drag force comes out of correctly analyzing the Poynting vector. And so all these sonic booms, the energy density and so forth, and the Poynting vector, will carry the same normalization of square root of lambda and not a factor of n squared.
The little picture doing the holographic mapping to boundary is not really describing the same physics as radiating closed strings, which I thought was what your question was sort of touching on.
But if you take nc to infinity, they substitute radiating closed strings goes to zero, right? So how can you then have a finite friction coefficient if you don't have any energy profile deposited in the boundary?
Well, there's also the translation of the metric perturbation into the stress energy tensor. Basically, it all works.
Okay.
Yes, please.
When you quoted V2 over delta, how did you calculate V2?
At mid rapidity, the expectation value of cost phi.
Cost phi expectation value taken with what weight? What do you take?
Energy density weight.
That may not be the same thing that they measure, because they weighted with this momentum spectrum. And for example, if you just take plus 5 weighted with momentum spectrum, or you take px squared minus py squared, which is pt squared cos phi, it's a factor of 2. And so you have to be careful with the comparison.
I disclaimed it. I said, don't get too excited. Over 0.37 versus 0.32.
Okay, let's do it.
I wonder, when we talk about reason, say, what would be the projection? Let's say they go to higher energies. What would be your expectation? What I wonder about, do you think that, say, the fact that Calvin constant is running down would show up, or it still would be kind of some interaction?
I would certainly expect that life will become more challenging, that lambda will go down effectively, and that the alpha prime cube corrections would become more important. I think I would be reluctant to hazard a guess on whether the LHC will produce a strongly coupled or weakly coupled quark-gluon plasma. That sounds like that sounds like something that I'd go to a bookie for. So perhaps we can make our bets as products.
Okay, let's thank all those speakers.